Rebecca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Gadars. Our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Meadows, Anna Osbeck, Matt Ealy. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Springtime Carnival, Thursday, August 31st at McMenamin's Crystal Ballroom in Portland. Springtime Carnival is a one-woman project led by Greta Morgan that plays fusion of sunshine pop, psychedelica, and folk rock filtered through the lens of indie rock. Again, that's Springtime Carnival, Thursday, August 31st at 8 p.m. at McMenamin's Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032. To volunteer with the KBOO Evening News.
It is 5 p.m. and coming up next we have KBOO Evening News. This program has been made possible by KBOO members and support from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Veterans Affairs Secretary Dr. David Shulkin discussed parking lot suicides at an address at Georgetown University.
A fish farm on Cypress Island near the San Juans had several thousand fish escape, and Washington State Fish and Wildlife officials are encouraging everyone to come and catch them.
And a Canadian town released a statement refusing to remove swastikas from a public park.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 23rd, 2017. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants to thank the eclipse.
For a couple of days, we weren't talking about Trump or global politics. We were talking about how nature would affect us, not the other way around. We made plans, changed plans, had visitors, chuckled at the actions of others. The media, as usual, tried to panic us, predicting gridlock, gas shortages, system breakdown. And Monday, we were united in amazement, moonstruck, whether in totality or Portland's 99.6%. Some deep primitive parts in us sensed the strangeness, the sun going down at the wrong time in the wrong place. We marveled through our safety glasses at the shrinking sun, the round inverted shadows that seemed to rise 3D from the streets on the sides of buildings, and ripples of illusion swirling around us as if even the air was transformed, liberated. We'll remember that morning more than where were you when 9/11 or JFK, and now we return to August drought and smoke, to our lacks of resources and opportunities, to the daily joys of another smile and something yummy, trying to not think of the darkness flooding out of Washington and our greedy would-be masters. We've put away our eclipse glasses and wish we couldn't see so much unfiltered. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Governor Kate Brown and State Police Superintendent Travis Hampton defended Oregon's marijuana industry in letters to U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Sessions has been hinting at a crackdown on states such as Oregon that have legalized pot in defiance of federal law, and in a letter to Brown, had referenced a draft report from the Oregon State Police that concluded a significant amount of Oregon's marijuana was being diverted to other states. Both Brown and Hampton said that the draft report was invalid and contained incorrect data and conclusions. They said the report was based on information collected before the state began regulating recreational marijuana and didn't reflect the current situation. A new Oregon law requires tracking all pot grown for legal sale from seed to store, reducing diversion into illegal markets. The governors of Alaska and Washington also recently pushed back against the Trump administration and defended their efforts to regulate the marijuana industry.
Oregon State taxpayers will get a refund because of the Oregon kicker law, but that refund no longer has the kick it used to have. When the state collects 2% more than was predicted 2 years ago because of income growth higher than expected, the kicker is triggered and the state must refund all the extra money. However, the state no longer issues kicker checks, but instead, saving the cost of processing and mailing those checks, credits the amount to your state income tax in the following tax year. The average credit is expected to be around $225, with the median credit being $90.
A fish farm on Cypress Island near the San Juans had several thousand fish escape, and Washington State Fish and Wildlife officials are encouraging everyone to come and catch them. The escaped fish are Atlantic salmon, which could increase survival problems for native salmon through crossbreeding as well as by feeding on baby Pacific salmon. Fishing for the escapees is limited to areas currently open for catching Pacific salmon and trout, but there are no size or catch limits on the Atlantic salmon, which are fine to eat. The Atlantic salmon have large black spots on their gill covers, which native salmon and steelhead do not. More detailed information on identifying Atlantic salmon is on Washington Fish and Wildlife's website.
In the military community, they call them parking lot suicides. The term refers to the decision of some military veterans to take their own lives on the grounds of Veterans Affairs facilities. VA Secretary Dr. David Shulkin noted the disturbing trend last week in an address at Georgetown University. Suicides at VA facilities are especially troubling. Shulkin could not identify any single cause, but noted that veterans who kill themselves on VA property don't want their families to have to discover them. Other reasons in actual cases have included denial of treatment. Shulkin has made veteran suicide his top clinical priority. He stressed the need for the Department of Veterans Affairs to do more to curb veteran suicides, estimated at 20 each day nationwide. That is correct, 20 suicides by veterans every day. Senator Ron Wyden was in Portland this morning to join a seminar conducted by a group called Lines for Life. This organization runs a national veterans crisis line from a bank of phones in an office building on Southwest McAdam. Here's Senator Wyden speaking with Dwight Holton of Lines for Life on their ambassador program.
This program, in my view, is the future of how we make sure we care for veterans, particularly older veterans, in a compassionate way. As I asked, my sense is that opioid addiction has hit Oregon like a wrecking ball. We saw statistics recently that we have a very high percentage of those individuals, older people, and what the staff confirmed today is that they think a lot of those folks, older veterans, often living in rural areas, they may have one or two chronic conditions like heart disease and diabetes, and Lines for Life is clearly a program that is there for those older veterans when the alarm bell rings. And I'm proud to have been able to play a modest role in working with Dwight Holton and his team in giving Oregon a chance to be a national model, particularly for caring for the older veteran. It means that not only are we going to be able to serve veterans here, and I was struck by some of the callers asking, for example, a vet, has your son talked to you recently? So it was clear that that was a vet who was lonely. And the ambassador program basically lets us show that this is a model that others can pick up on. In other words, there are going to be an awful lot of veterans helped inside these walls. And with the ambassador program, they're going to be able to be helped elsewhere.
With the Ambassador Program, we're going to be able to continue the work we do reaching veterans in crisis 24/7, 365. Every day of the year, we are here. Every hour of the year, we are here, ready to serve vets. With the Ambassador Program, the Veterans Administration has chosen Lines for Life to be its primary partner to work with their two Veterans Crisis Centers to meet with and help people through phone, text, or otherwise who are in crisis, not just in Oregon, but around the nation, and in fact, around the globe. So we're really thrilled with the trust they've placed in us, with the capacity we will be building here, adding 26 call counselors. It means we'll be able to talk to thousands more people, to help thousands more people, to help thousands more vets.
And it's important to note that this recognition for Lines for Life didn't happen by osmosis. When the new head of the VA, Dr. David Shulkin, came to see me in the spring, of course, the administrations were changing, the Trump administration coming in. They didn't have all of the details on the wonderful work being done at Lines for Life. And so we had a chance to be, in effect, a go-between between this program and the new administration. And they were aware that my background has been working with healthcare. But make no mistake about it, this program convinced the new administration that they ought to be able, through the Ambassador Program, to play a larger role, and I see my job is to keep building on it, particularly with innovative programs to take care of that older veteran who we all heard this morning is really the person who often falls between the cracks.
There can be no doubt Senator Wyden has been a longtime champion for veterans and for veterans health care. His forceful and thoughtful help at the Veterans Administration, explaining the needs of veterans health, of the needs of veterans in crisis, was essential to this Ambassador Center project. It was essential to the work we will be doing at Lines for Life, to our adding our capacity to all the jobs who are coming to Oregon to help us meet the need of veterans in crisis.
That was Senator Ron Wyden speaking about Lines for Life, a national hotline for veterans in crisis.
At a rally in Phoenix last night, the president dished out more of the same vitriol and victimhood to a crowd of supporters. The main differences from his campaign rallies last year were the current events he was reacting to and the way observers are reacting to him. One new trend observed by the Washington Post was the gradual lapse of attention from the audience, many of whom had waited for hours in 100-plus degree heat, only to have their water bottles confiscated at the door. This was also the president's first rally since his comments after the murder of Heather Heyer by a white supremacist in Charlottesville, Virginia on August 12th. He lashed out at, quote, the media for supposedly misrepresenting his multiple statements blaming, quote, both sides for the violence. The president did make a statement calling out white supremacist groups by name, but it was widely seen as insincere, in as much as it was sandwiched in between statements blaming counter-protesters and downplaying the seriousness of white supremacist gatherings. Indeed, he doubled down on blaming both sides at the rally in Phoenix last night. Among other statements, the president also threatened to allow a government shutdown if Congress does not set aside funding for a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. He issued barely veiled put-downs of Arizona's two Republican senators, John McCain and Jeff Flake, for voting against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
The president still enjoys the support of about 20-25% of the populace. The rest of the nation, though, seems to be increasingly against him, and last night's rally did not help. Today, seven members of the National Infrastructure Advisory Council resigned in protest of the administration. The council is part of the Department of Homeland Security and advises the president on the safety and security of the nation's transportation and energy infrastructure. In a collective resignation letter, the former council members wrote, quote, "The moral infrastructure of our nation is the foundation on which the physical infrastructure is built. The administration's actions undermine that foundation." On the streets of Phoenix, thousands showed up last night to protest the rally, which itself was attended by around 15,000 supporters of the president. While there aren't any notable violence outside during the rally, tensions escalated towards the end. Police say that some protesters threw bottles and rocks at officers, while others claim the protesters threw gas canisters, though nobody outside the Phoenix PD has confirmed this. Police responded with tear gas, flashbang grenades, pepper spray, and pepper balls, similar to the weaponry used on the June 4th protest to clear anti-fascist protesters out of Chapman Square in downtown Portland. Four protesters were arrested.
It appears that former Sheriff Joe Arpaio might be getting a pardon after all, letting him off the hook from the infamous racial profiling case. The Independent is reporting that President Trump's staff has prepared the necessary paperwork in addition to writing talking points intended for major news cable networks. Arpaio was accused of many crimes against ethnic communities, including detaining immigrants who had not committed any crimes. Arpaio would force these immigrants to sleep outside in a detention facility during temperatures that could reach as high as 120 degrees, in addition to wearing pink underwear as a form of demarcation. Arpaio was also found to have systematically violated the rights of Latinos. All programs that a federal judge presiding over the case referred to as, quote, ludicrous and crap. Arpaio would have faced up to 6 months in prison for contempt of court after his refusal to comply with orders to cease his unlawful detention programs. President Trump made a statement concerning this case after his speech in Arizona, in which he said Arpaio would, quote, be okay.
Now, here's the National Native News from our colleagues at Native Voice One.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous people were among crowds outside the Phoenix Convention Center Tuesday protesting President Trump's visit to Arizona. Nalan Tyke was with the group, which included people from different tribes. She says they gathered together to show opposition of the Trump administration and advocate for indigenous issues.
To come in unity, because we feel that these political leaders in this country right now are not right for the people. And we as indigenous people are the first that should be having our voice heard. And we're here in spiritual prayers and as one people for nonviolent, but to come together for unity and to make sure that this country goes in good hands for the future of our generations.
Tyke was there representing the Apache Stronghold, a group which works to protect sacred sites, including Oak Flat, from development.
This leader right now that's here and for our country, he will not protect our future generations. And that's where I want my voice to be heard.
Some Native people in the state are also concerned with ending Indian mascots and logos and oppose the administration's plan to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. Cher Thomas is with the group Arizona Stands, which helped organize the march.
There are certain rights and dignities that we are currently being denied, and that especially goes back to our traditional land. There's a lot of issues in Arizona regarding land, and some of these things are impacted directly by the policies of the administration and also by certain executive orders that are being loomed over our head as some kind of weird threat.
Meanwhile, inside the convention center, Trump rallied supporters and commented on a number of areas, including the enforcement of immigration laws, border issues, and blasted journalists, calling the press dishonest. The company which built the Dakota Access Pipeline filed suit against Greenpeace and other environmental groups Tuesday, alleging they disseminated false information and interfered with construction. Reporter Bree Ripley has more.
Texas-based Energy Transfer Partners alleges that the group's actions opposing the pipeline interfered with business, incited violence, and facilitated crimes and acts of terrorism. The company says activists targeted financial institutions that backed the project and violated racketeering and defamation laws. The pipeline was delayed for months due to legal wrangling and on-the-ground protests by tribes and groups that fear environmental harm. The lawsuit filed in federal court in North Dakota seeks damages that could approach $1 billion. Greenpeace attorney Tom Wetterer said in a recorded statement that the lawsuit is meritless and alleges this is a second consecutive year that President Trump's attorneys have singled out the organization. Energy Transfer Partners is represented by Kasowitz Benson Torres LLP, a law firm whose managing partner, Mark Kasowitz, is President Donald Trump's longtime personal attorney.
It's yet another classic strategic lawsuit against public participation, or a SLAP.
A SLAP is intended to censor groups of people by hampering their efforts, or what Wetterer refers to as Greenpeace's legitimate advocacy work, with expensive and time-consuming litigation.
What this has become is a pattern of harassment by corporate bullies, with Trump's attorneys leading the way.
The 1,200-mile pipeline began moving North Dakota oil through South Dakota and Iowa to a distribution point in Illinois June 1st. For National Native News, I'm Bree Ripley in Billings, Montana.
The Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma is hosting a series of legal classes in the next couple weeks and in September for class members in the Indian Trust Cobell settlement. The clinics will assist Chickasaw citizens and other Native Americans with information and deadlines for a payment in November. The historic lawsuit settles individual claims in the billions over the mismanagement of Indian Trust by the U.S. government. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The class struggle in Venezuela between workers and the poor on one side and the oligarchy right wing on the other is being reported by corporate media as a struggle between dictatorship and democracy. But three New York City area trade unionists who visited Venezuela during the Constituent Assembly elections say you should not believe that dictatorship versus democracy media narrative. Estela Vasquez is Executive Vice President of 1199 SEIU Healthcare Workers East.
You cannot rely on CNN or any of the other international communication or papers like the New York Times or the Washington Post, because they are only reflecting the story of the ruling classes, the oligarchy of this country that wants to preserve their interests.
When Hugo Chavez was elected president in 1998, he launched reforms that significantly improved the lives of working and poor Venezuelans. The oligarchy, the one percenters, resented and were threatened by the reforms. So they began working hard to destabilize Venezuela, to destroy those reforms. They attempted a 2002 coup, but it failed. Judy Gonzalez is an RN and president of the New York State Nurses Association. She says healthcare is free in Venezuela. Even complex heart surgery is free. And she says far from dictatorship, the Constituent Assembly elections were peaceful and open democratic elections. The violent episodes, she said, against these elections were coming from the right-wing oligarchy.
The violence was being committed by the right wing, by the wealthy classes and people that they were either paying or influencing in a particular way to commit these acts of violence, some of which were horrendous. And the purpose was to terrorize people into not voting. I think there are serious problems in the country right now, but these problems are fomented by a right wing, a wealthy class that's not happy with the changes that are necessary and needed to create a better quality of life.
J.P. Patafio is with the Transit Workers Union Local 100 in New York. He toured Caracas, Venezuela with the Venezuelan Transport Workers Union. What he saw were workers determined to control their own fates and tangible evidence of Hugo Chavez's efforts to invest in housing for the homeless and public infrastructure for the people.
I saw 30 apartment buildings that he built for people to live in. And the guy estimated at least 1 million people were given homes that did not have a home. And these are new buildings. I saw huge investments in infrastructure that cost pennies for people to travel from one part of the city to the other. Brand new, you know? And I saw workers doing their thing, and they were ready. And I think they're ready to take on the challenge.
Let's get America working. We must build, maintain, and repair our nation's crumbling infrastructure. Teamster support a bipartisan approach to creating good jobs for American workers. Learn more at letsgetamericaworking.com. Teamster strong, America stronger.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
Now let's look at this day in labor history.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1900. That was the day that folk singer Malvina Reynolds was born to a Jewish family in San Francisco. Her parents were socialists and operated a tailor shop. Malvina learned the price of speaking out for what you believe in at a young age. Her parents opposed U.S. entry into World War I. Because of this, Malvina's high school would not issue her a diploma. She was able to still go to college at Berkeley, where she eventually earned her PhD. She married carpenter and labor organizer William Bud Reynolds. She became a prolific folk singer, playing around the Los Angeles area. During the 1960s, she wrote about songs supporting civil rights and labor rights. Her song, Free Enterprise, offers the lyrics, "The air you breathe is poison, the food you eat is worse, the dollars in your paycheck are pennies in your purse. There's nothing free about it, you pay at every turn, except the guys in Wall Street who have the stuff to burn. They had to make new brain machines to count their profits rise, but since there's always room for more, they can still make their profits soar. A little war does wonders for free enterprise." Perhaps her most well-known song is Little Boxes. the song was inspired by driving by hillside houses in Daly City, California. It talks about the conformity of middle-class suburbia.
Where they are put in boxes and they come out all the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes made of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
And a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo at 6, it's The Underground, followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather is a low of 61 with a slight chance of showers. Tomorrow's high expected to be 75. Today in history, in 1970, Lou Reed played his last concert with the Velvet Underground. A recording of the concert, Live at Max's Kansas City, was released in 1972. Quote of the day is also from Lou Reed. There's a bit of magic in everything, and a little loss to even things out.
The president's response to white supremacist violence in Charlottesville has been met with widespread criticism, including several protest rallies around the United States and many cancellations for charity events at his Mar-a-Lago resort. And now it appears that the Jewish community is adding their own voice. It's an annual tradition that the top rabbis in the United States organize and hold an annual conference call with the president before the Jewish high holidays. This tradition was upheld each year that President Barack Obama was in office, but now these rabbis are stating that they will not be organizing this event at all, citing Trump's late, lackluster, and seemingly bigoted response. A joint statement issued by the rabbis said, quote, "We have concluded that the president's statements after the tragic events in Charlottesville are so lacking in moral leadership and empathy for the victims of racial and religious hatred that we cannot organize such a call this year." The rabbis went on to state that the fault for the death of Heather Hayes lies squarely on the shoulders of the Nazis, the alt-right, and white supremacists, saying, quote, "They must be roundly condemned at all events."
Earlier today, the Navy announced that Vice Admiral Joseph Aucoin has been dismissed from his position as commander of the 7th Fleet. Aucoin was relieved by Admiral Scott Swift, commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, due to, quote, "a loss of confidence in his ability to command." Rear Admiral Phil Sawyer will take over in assuming command of the 7th Fleet based in Yokosuka, Japan. The commander's removal comes after a series of ship collisions in the Pacific arena. There have been 4 accidents involving U.S. Navy ships so far this year, the most recent on Monday involving the USS John S. McCain and a Liberian tanker off the coast of Singapore. 10 sailors were reported to be missing. Since the accident, remains of some of the missing sailors have been found. The White House released a statement on Tuesday stating, quote, "As the Navy begins the process of recovering our fallen sailors, our thoughts and prayers go out to their families and friends. The Department of Defense will conduct a thorough and complete investigation of the incident." The naval forces have since announced that officials are investigating how factors of training, manning, and other internal operations may have had a role in the collisions.
4 associates of the Bundy clan got good news yesterday in their second trial after their first trial resulted in a hung jury. These trials arose from a 2014 standoff in Nevada between armed militia members and federal agents attempting to round up cattle belonging to Clive and Bundy. Stephen Stewart and Ricky Loveline were acquitted of all 10 charges they faced, while the cases against Scott Drexler and Eric Parker resulted in mistrials because the jury could not reach unanimous decisions. Ammon and Ryan Bundy, who led the takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Preserve in eastern Oregon, were scheduled for trial in late September with their father Cliven Bundy, but that date may now change.
And now here's the latest in drug laws and regulation with the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Eric Sterling, the director of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, was my guest on last week's Cultural Baggage program.
Eric, I want to interject the thought that it is in California, or certainly in Oakland, where they are making arrangements for those who were previously arrested, incarcerated for marijuana sales or growth, to actually become part of that industry, which is a step in that direction, right?
I think that's a very positive corrective step. It seems absurd to me to say that people who worked in these, who are selling drugs illegally, now can't get involved in this industry when it's legal. As long as they follow the rules in this new industry, they have a passion for it. They shouldn't be disqualified because they have a drug conviction, in my opinion.
You know, I would agree. There's a similar scenario up in Canada where all of the people who helped change the laws, helped change perspectives insofar as cannabis, are now being denied the ability to participate in the industry. It's just not right.
Now, many states, have drug law, have cannabis laws like this. In Maryland, the medical cannabis law forbids people who had a felony drug conviction from working in the legal medical cannabis industry in Maryland.
I don't understand the logic, but again, there's not much logic in drug war laws in the first place. Well, Eric, I know you have worked with the U.S. Congress. Congressman Peter Rodino, was that it? The year was 86, about, was it, sir?
So in 1986, a Maryland basketball star who was very, very well known inside the Beltway signed with the Boston Celtics, who had won the NBA championship. And the night that he signed with the Celtics, he came back home and he was partying, and he died from a cocaine seizure in his dormitory at the University of Maryland. This really shocked the country, and it shocked members of Congress, and the Speaker of the House, who was from Boston, Tip O'Neill, figured out that perhaps the Democrats could take advantage of the drug issue instead of the Republicans. A huge Democratic-inspired drug bill was put together. I was the drugs guy for the House Judiciary Committee, and so I was drafted into these meetings, and I was involved in writing what became the very infamous mandatory minimum drug sentences in 1986.
Tune in tomorrow to hear the rest of this thought from Eric Sterling, president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. I am Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Now here's today's edition of Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Wake up and smell the climate change. A new study shows that Americans sleep less on unusually warm nights, and we're seeing more of them as the climate warms. Nick Abradovich is with the Science, Technology, and Public Policy program at the Harvard Kennedy School. He began researching the topic after experiencing a few of his own rough nights.
There was a heat wave when I was living in San Diego and finishing up my PhD, and it was the hottest October that San Diego had ever experienced. The nighttime temperatures were particularly warm, and so I had a lot of time lying in bed not being able to sleep very well.
It inspired him to study the potential links between climate change, nighttime temperature, and sleep. He and his team combed through a decade's worth of sleep surveys and weather data from across the U.S. They found that abnormally high temperatures match up with reports of a bad night's sleep. Elderly and low-income communities are the most affected.
This is just one study among many, many studies that is starting to uncover the degree to which humans are affected by the climate and the degree to which we're very likely to be affected by that climate changing in the future.
How's that for a wake-up call? Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Now we'll hear some of the latest edition of the Green News Report.
Across the U.S. Midwest, farmers are blaming widespread crop damage to millions of acres of farmland on a new version of an old pesticide.
Monsanto pesticide, approved by secret process, is decimating crops. Trump disbands Federal Advisory Committee on Climate Change. Court lets Exxon off the hook for Arkansas pipeline spill that destroyed a neighborhood. Plus, the National Park Service ends the ban on plastic disposable water bottles.
Because of course they do. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Reuters examination has found that the crisis has its roots in weak regulatory oversight and corporate secrecy.
Because they all do. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, there has been much talk about Donald Trump and his various business advisory groups disbanding. Well, now he has disbanded a climate advisory group, but they're not going away that easily.
No, they are definitely not. Just days after President Donald Trump rescinded a federal requirement that infrastructure be built with sea level rise projections in mind, now the administration has disbanded a federal advisory committee on climate change that makes concrete recommendations for long-term planning on a wide range of issues, from building codes to water infrastructure to road projects to even managing energy supply.
So the people who would have told him, hey, it's a bad idea to not require federal infrastructure to be able to withstand flooding, Donald Trump just got rid of those people.
Yes, it was supposed to help communities plan ahead for the impacts of global warming. But in an interview with The Washington Post, the committee's chairman, University of Maryland geology professor Richard Moss, said the group intends to finish their report anyway, saying, quote, we're going to be running huge risks here and possibly end up hurting the next generation's economic prospects.
So good for them. They're not going away that easy.
No, they're not. Meanwhile, Midwest farmers have asked the EPA to investigate serious crop damage that the farmers say was caused by a new formulation of an old pesticide, dicamba, that drifted onto fields with crops unable to withstand it. An investigation by Reuters has now found that the manufacturer of dicamba, biochemical giant Monsanto, blocked independent testing during the approval process. Monsanto explicitly prohibited university researchers from testing the new formulation's tendency to vaporize and drift across to other fields. The Obama administration EPA approved it anyway, according to Reuters.
Monsanto provided its own study of the advanced weed-killing chemical to the EPA, which determined that based on the information it had, the product was safe to use.
The EPA simply took Monsanto's word for it?
Yes, that's how pesticides pretty much get approved in the United States.
And that's how our federal government worked before Donald Trump came in to do away with the quote-unquote regulators.
Also, the Trump National Park Service has ended a ban on the sale of plastic disposable water bottles in the nation's national parks after aggressive lobbying by the bottled water industry. The ban was instituted in 2011 after Park Service data showed discarded plastic bottles were the biggest source of litter in the nation's parks, killing animals that mistook the plastic pieces for food and straining the National Park Service's already inadequate budget to clean it up. Despite data showing that the ban reduced the burden and cost of plastic bottle pollution, the bottled water industry got the final say.
They always do.
In Arkansas, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has let ExxonMobil off the hook in the 2013 pipeline spill in Mayflower, Arkansas, that ruined an entire residential neighborhood. The court overturned nearly all of a $2.5 million fine imposed by the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration for failing to adequately monitor the 70-year-old pipeline. Exxon argued in court that the pipeline spill wasn't its fault because the regulations didn't specifically warn them that they needed to more closely monitor that type of old pipeline. The court agreed with Exxon. In other words, if you lobby to weaken regulations and then there's a problem, you can blame the weak regulations for not stopping
you. Wow.
And a new report calculates that overall, fines for polluters in general with the Trump administration have dropped 60% under its first 6 months. That's compared to the same period of time for previous presidents, according to a new report from the Environmental Integrity Project, an environmental watchdog nonprofit group.
Incredible. Game the regulators and then blame the regulators. They got you coming and going, don't they?
They certainly do.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, and there are a lot of them, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Play the game, play the game, play the game, play the game.
A Canadian town released a statement refusing to remove swastikas in a public park, stating that they have, quote, historical significance. The town in question is Pointe-Cascade, located in the province of Quebec. The statement comes after Mayor Gilles Santerre had police remove a man who was trying to paint over the swastikas that covered two anchors in the city park. Situated below the anchors reads a plaque that identifies the artifacts as a souvenir of Nazism. The plaque further reads that it was used in Europe at the end of the war and found in 1980. However, on the town's official website, Mayor Santerre states that the anchor predates World War II and was uncovered by local divers 25 years ago. He also says that the village of Pointe-Cascade does not in any way endorse Nazism.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kunsel Doma, Sam Bowman, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Kyle Carezzi. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Stay tuned immediately after this newscast for News from the BOO coming up in just a few seconds. At 6 o'clock, we'll have The Underground with KBOO's Youth Collective, and then at 7 o'clock, it'll be Hard Knock Radio. Have a great evening.
And now it's time for News from the BOO, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Hello and welcome to News from the BOO, your weekly update about what is happening in and around KBOO. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and today I'm super happy to be joined by one of our volunteer, Colin Stevens. And we're going to learn more about Colin's involvement with KBOO and also about a radio station that he just started in his backyard. Hi, Colin. Welcome to News from the BOO.
Hello. It's nice to be here on this afternoon.
Start by telling us maybe a little bit about you and how you became involved with KBOO.
Okay, so let's see. About a while ago, I was thinking about, you know, joining KBOO, and I was like, hey, I should do this. And the problem was, is I went into junior year of high school, and if anybody out there is listening and they're, you know, were junior in high school a few years ago, just take everything from that year and, you know, make it a little more complex. They've definitely changed a lot of things, and it puts a lot more like stress on people. And in that way, I literally had no time for about 9 months to do anything. So I had to set it aside. And when I went to the Blues Festival in July and I saw the booth, I'm like, oh yeah, I was supposed to maybe volunteer. So I ended up going to the orientation meeting And, you know, literally the next day I was helping out, which is great because it is important to, you know, volunteer for what you believe in, regardless of your lifestyle. And at the time, I had problems with time management. So it's definitely better now. With being a senior, a lot of this stuff is now out of the way.
Yeah, that's cool. So why radio? What is it about radio that attracted you? You say, like, the Blues Festival, you had heard about K-Boo before. Like, what is it that motivated you to want to learn this medium?
I think, well, I'm on the school newspaper at Cleveland High School, which is the Clarion, and I took a journalism class freshman year, and I found the medium interesting just in newspaper alone, not to mention, you know, journalism as a whole. And I thought, you know, this is kind of fun. I enjoy this. And I enjoyed writing commentaries about technology and drawing art and images. And being an editor now, I take great stride in being an editor. I'm very gracious that I even have the possibility of being an editor for a newspaper, especially when school newspapers are definitely a thing that is not in very many high schools anymore. And I've always been, ever since I was a kid, I was always interested with technology and any sort of like electronic stuff. And I remember, you know, taking things apart that I shouldn't have when I was a kid, like old like radios and stuff, and looking inside of them and old keyboards, and I'm like, wow, how does this work? And over time, it kind of got settled into more like areas instead of just general stuff. I started getting interested in the older things because there was so much more variety and style in them. And I ended up finding this special place for like old telephone equipment and old like radio equipment. And I always found it very cool to transmit any sort of thing miles away. And everybody takes this stuff for granted. And it's actually really neat from the perspective of knowing how it works. And over the years, I started picking up old like radios and telephones at yard sales, and I started collecting them. And, you know, I don't know if that's good or bad, considering my room looks like it's from 1969 now, but it's all right. And over the years, I've kind of gained this opinion on radio in the Portland area, where there really isn't much that pertains to me. You know, everybody's different in a way. But I always found that a few radio stations